Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the House Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And we have a quorum present. And the first order of business is approval of the minutes of January 31st.
Madam, I'd like to approve the minutes, please.
All right. Thank you, Vice Chair Bierman. So Representative Bierman has moved approval of the minutes of January 31st. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. So today we are going to hear a number of bills dealing with lead, a really important public health issue. And because we're going to hear a number of bills on the same theme, we're going to start out with a presentation from the Minnesota Department of Health on this issue. So we have a bit of an overview to kind of frame up our discussion. And so we welcome Mr. Assistant Commissioner Dan Huff from MDH to do that overview. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here, Mr. Huff.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As Chair Liebling said, my name is Dan Huff, and I am the Assistant Commissioner of Health Protection with the Minnesota Department of Health. And I wanted to just start today, if that's okay with you, Chair, with an overview of lead exposure and what that means.
And Mr. Huff, yeah, I was just going to asking Ms. Niedernhofer if the mics are doing what they're supposed to do, because in this room they tend to be kind of soft, so you do have to lean into it a little bit.
Thank you. I will lean in. So first of all, lead impacts children disproportionately than it does adults, and that is because children are growing and they're developing, and lead interferes with that growth and development. And one thing is that there is no safe level of lead. Lead is toxic, and the more lead you get, the more toxic it is, but there is no safe level. And it impacts, especially in children, learning and behavior. Lead impacts all of us, regardless of our age, because it is toxic. And it can result in memory loss, brain impact. It impacts our kidneys, can create high blood pressure. It really creates system-wide impacts in the human body. And one of the more significant issues for children, because children are developing and their brains especially are developing, is that lead exposure actually reduces brain function and reduces IQ. And depending on the amount of lead that a child is exposed to, the more lead, the more loss of brain function and the loss of IQ. If you have an elevated blood lead of 10 micrograms per deciliter to 20, that results in about a 4 to 8 loss or IQ point loss. And then at higher levels, it can be 6 to 12 or even higher, depending on the level of exposure of lead. And every child in Minnesota can be exposed to lead. Every county, we do have children that are exposed to lead. And if you look at this map here, that predominant sort of light green color, that's our average. So any county here that has an average level of exposure, the yellow is below average exposure, below the average. And then those darker colors that, whether it be that aqua or that dark blue, that's where you have higher levels than the background or the average. And if we look at the metro area, we see that, and this is due to older housing stock with more lead paint and deteriorating lead paint, you can see that neighborhoods that have a disproportionate burden of children that suffer from lead poisoning. Well, how do we know this? Well, when a child goes to their well child visit, their family takes them, so their pediatrician or family physician will usually take a capillary prick of blood from their finger, and that is analyzed for lead. If lead is present, then usually a venous draw is taken, so that is blood from the vein, And then that is sent to a laboratory, and we at MDH get the results of that. And for children that have elevated blood lead levels, we send a note to local public health to follow up with the family, and we also make sure that the family is followed up on to investigate the source of the lead exposure. And either we or local public health will actually meet with the family and do a full assessment inside the home. We check for lead paint. We check, especially around windows, using dust wipes. We take soil samples in the yard. And we also look at what other types of products in the home might be resulting in lead exposure of the child. And what we have found is that there are some really common sources of these lead poisonings in children. Number one is chipped and peeling lead paint. And it doesn't have to be visibly peeling or chipping. It can be just the dust of moving up and down a window sash that collects. We know that children are very, especially toddler age, you know, they're always putting things in their mouth. And if there's lead dust, that's going in and being ingested. We have found also that spices, jewelry, pottery, various things, candy, imported candy, has had lead in it. Jewelry, keys, toys. I actually had some toys when my kids were little. I took in to the health department, had them tested, and they had lead in them. So I quickly got rid of those because kids love to chew on their toys. But also take-home lead. Say from a hobby of the parent or workplace of the parent, bringing home lead that their children are exposed to. So what about water? Water was not mentioned in one of those. Water is a source of lead exposure, and it creates a base level of lead in anyone who's exposed to drinking water with lead. And I want to point out these two tables here. Please note that the y-axis is at a different scale, so these bars are not comparable in that way. But if you look at the top graph, that's 0 to 6 months. At 0 to 6 months, water is a disproportionate exposure because kids drink a lot of water for their body weight. And you can see that this blue level here, that is the burden of water lead on this young cohort based upon their exposure level. And then even as children get older, that still continues to be a base lead level. So exposure in water, if you will, already adds some level of lead. And then these other sources just compound that. So again, no level of lead is safe. And if we look at how lead travels through water and gets into someone's home or in someone's faucet, first we have the service line that's going from, say, the municipality that's often in the street, underground into the home. And there's usually a curb stop where it is now the owner's responsibility as opposed to, say, the city's responsibility. And then once it gets inside the house, then we have our plumbing fixtures, such as a faucet. Faucets have lead in them. And depending on when they were manufactured, they have more or less lead. As we have gotten, you know, closer to today, more and more lead has been banned. But it can be in the solder that was used for the plumbing fixtures and in the plumbing fixtures themselves. I recently had my service line replaced, and I felt I was safe because my service line entering my house was galvanized. I looked at that because I'm in this profession. You know, I work in public health. Well, to my shock, when they replaced my service line, they told me the first 10 feet was lead. I had no way of knowing that, because it's underground. I unwittingly exposed my children to water that had lead in it. And I care about lead a lot, because that's my profession. So there again is just sort of a reference for the different exposures within the home. Madam Chair, that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to take questions. And I'm also joined by a number of my colleagues who are the real experts in this, so I may call them up if you...
All right. Well, Mr. Huff, thank you. Assistant Commissioner Huff, thank you so very much for that. And it is really sobering to think about. You know, just kind of as we look back at what we know about how health is impacted, things like this, you know, that aren't health care make up, as we know, a huge portion of what we think of as health. So really important topic today. So are there questions from members on the presentation? Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I know the answer to this, but I just want to hear it from you directly. Is there any level that's safe or at least not unsafe of exposure for kids?
And Mr. Huff, if you could repeat the question because it was very soft.
Oh, that was...
Yeah, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative, the question was, is there any safe level of lead? And the answer is no. Lead is toxic, and the smallest amount is toxic. And the more you have, the more toxic it is. So there is no safe level of lead.
Representative Carroll.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that. The question was not unsafe. It's a double negative, I know, but I'm just wondering if there's a distinction with a difference there between not unsafe and safe in terms of lead exposure.
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Madam Chair, Representative, can you say that again, please? I'm losing the double negative.
So, exposure to lead is unsafe. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, Madam Chair. So any exposure? So if you're exposed the smallest amount, that's unsafe.
Mr. Huff.
Madam Chair. So the question is the smallest exposure unsafe? So lead is toxic. And you don't want any lead. So we say that no level of lead is safe. It's always difficult to say what is the impact of one amount versus another amount on any given individual. But what we know is that because lead is toxic, it is there is no level of safe lead. Does that help answer your question, Representative?
Representative Carroll.
Yes. Yes, it does, exactly. And if I could, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So I served for a long time as general counsel to Metropolitan Health Plan. It's a safety net health plan, worked closely with MDH on lead abatement procedures. You put it into the contract in terms of having the health plan help with remediation efforts. I think that was a great cause that you had. It was challenging for the health plans, at least for my health plan, to accommodate, but nonetheless, it was an important public safety, public health initiative, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Chair. Thank you, Representative Carroll. Okay, we have Representative Nadeau next.
Super quick. Thank you for being here. This is an important issue. Can you talk just a little bit about the work to date that's being done for lead abatement? I know that there's a lot of federal money that comes into the state, to the counties to do this work. Can you just talk about how our work to date has, if it's been effective, if it's been too short, too little, too least? I mean, Representative Carroll just talked about the health plans. Can you just talk about that overall effort that we've put in place so far?
Mr. Huff.
Madam Chair, Representative, if I may, I'd like to call one of my colleagues to help assist in that question so we can provide you more specifics. Would that be Mary or Stephanie? Okay. So Dr. Stephanie Indell is a supervisor in our lead surveillance program.
Welcome to the committee. If you would just state your name for the record and then go ahead. Do you need the question repeated?
No, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. My name is Dr. Stephanie Yendel, and as Assistant Commissioner Huff said, I am the supervisor of the lead surveillance program at the Minnesota Department of Health. To answer the question, yes, there have been a number of initiatives across the state looking at especially lead abatement. HUD in particular has provided quite a bit of funding, particularly within the city of Minneapolis, Hennepin County, and Ramsey County. And we have seen seen that where those dollars are going, we are decreasing the number of elevated blood lead levels among children that we see faster than we are in other parts of the state. We do have a HUD grant that was started just in 2020 in the southeast corner of the state. We're partnering with the city of Rochester and are just working on bringing the city of Austin online as well. And that program is still very much in its infancy to be able to speak much about results. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of resources in many of the other counties across the state, and so when our lead risk assessors go and they identify lead exposure in a home, it's really up to the property owner to self-fund those initiatives. There are a few options that may be available to homeowners. Sometimes there may be funding available through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency through particularly grants or low interest loans or through some of the health savings plans. If a family does happen to have a health savings plan, then they can use those pre-tax dollars to help address lead in their home. But generally speaking, they're having to self-fund abatement in most other portions of the state.
All right. Follow-up, Representative Nadeau?
No, I don't think so. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Department, for this great presentation. I think I know the answer, but upon detection of lead in the blood, is there any treatment?
Mr. Huff.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would like to refer that again to Dr. Yandell.
Madam Chair, Representative, so there are a few treatment options that are available. It's known as chelation therapy, and that's where a drug is administered to the child and it helps remove the lead from the system faster. If a child is potentially going to receive chelation, we typically consult with the Poison Control Center or a medical toxicologist because it is quite a severe treatment on the child's body. It removes not just lead, but other essential elements as well, such as calcium and iron. And so for the vast majority of children, the recommendation is to eliminate the source of lead exposure, stop that exposure, and then allow the body to remove the lead through the kidneys and through its own natural means.
Representative, any follow-up?
No, thank you very much. I just think that speaks to the toxicity of this heavy metal, so thank you.
And just what I think maybe needs to be followed up just a bit is the damage done, however, is permanent. Am I right?
Madam Chair, yes. Unfortunately, the damage is permanent. Many children can benefit from especially just really enriched educational services, and they can adapt and live wonderful lives. Unfortunately, the damage to their cells has been done and is permanent.
All right. Thank you. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I'd like to ask a follow-up on that, which is not my original question. Are the elevated blood levels, at what point are they detectable? I mean, is there a threshold of exposure before it is detected? I mean, if the lead is detectable, has damage already been done? Or is there a point at which, if it's early enough, if it's quickly enough, and we remove the sources, is it recoverable?
Dr. Yandell. Did I get your name right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. So there are a few different screening tests that are available at medical clinics. One of the most common ones is, as Assistant Commissioner Huff said, it's done through a capillary test, so a finger prick, and is run in-house at the clinic. And the limit of detection for that device is 3.3 micrograms per deciliter, and then there's a margin of error around that. That currently the Minnesota Department of Health and local public health responds at 5 micrograms per deciliter to begin education of the family and outreach, as well as the starting to investigate lead sources. There are more precise laboratory tests that can detect lead. Some of the tests go as low as 0.4 micrograms per deciliter. So while we know that there is no safe level of exposure to lead, as Assistant Commissioner Huff said, there is certainly a dose response curve. And so the more lead exposure we have, the more damage, the less lead exposure, the less damage. While there may be some damage at even very, very low levels of lead exposure, where we start to see the more noticeable signs is at the higher lead levels.
Okay, Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I was hoping, Mr. Huff, that we could go back to slide 10, and I'm wondering if you can just tell us a little bit more. You mentioned, you sort of talked about these water systems and how you had your water system replaced, but I'm wondering if you can just explain the numbers a little bit. So you estimate 100,000 in Minnesota. Is that 100,000 single-family homes being exposed? Can you just run through these numbers a little bit more and what we're talking about there?
Mr. Huff.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. We estimate that there are 100,000 service lines that are lead in Minnesota, and that is an estimate. My line probably would not have been in that estimate originally, and I don't know if any of the okay. Just make sure I didn't leave anything out there.
Oh, all right. Representative Brindley, and then we have one more member question after she's done, and then we're going to move to the bills. Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there an idea, and perhaps I missed this, I apologize, but is there an idea then? So that would be the lead service lines. It talks about homes with wells, and I know that, I can see the maps, but is there any idea how many households, and I don't know if that would include apartments, single family homes, do we have an idea of how many households are being affected by this right now? And like what is the scope? I look at the maps, but that's a little bit almost overwhelming, right? Like to really understand in real terms.
Yeah, and please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. My name is Chad Colstead. I'm the supervisor of the Drinking Water Protection Infrastructure Unit at Minnesota Department of Health. That is a good question, and that's one of the challenges, right? So we do not have, this is an estimate, we do not have a good understanding across the state as to how many lead service lines there truly are. We're probably pretty close with 100,000, but we're really not certain. EPA has recently passed new revisions to the lead and copper rule that require systems to do an inventory of their water services across the state. That's due by October 16th of 2024. So at that point, we'll have a better answer. But till then, yeah, the 100,000 is a pretty good guess, but it's just a guess, as Assistant Hoff said.
Representative New Brindley, final follow-up.
Just any idea of households affected?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's just a number of service lines, so that's, it's probably mainly households. Larger buildings, businesses typically have larger service lines, so they're not necessarily lead. Lead is usually up to about 2 inches, is about as large as lead was able to be installed, just because of the workability and weight of the pipe. So it's typically your residential homes.
Okay, Representative Fisher, and then we'll move to the bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question for the Assistant Commissioner goes back to the water gremlin lead issue that we had out there within the community. And for the committee a little bit, water gremlin was a manufacturer in the White Bear Lake area that had done a lot of contamination review with TCE in the area. One of the things that came out is that as this was going on, we found out that there had been a lot of lead poisoning that had been happening from the kids, from the workers leaving covered in lead and taking it home. And they found this issue a little bit beforehand. But one of the things that I felt in the process is the health department was trying to deal with it, is they were dealing with a company that was not genuine in addressing their issues out there, and it felt like that there were other issues going on where there needed to be looping in the Department of Labor, MPCA, and it felt like it was a process that did not work well in trying to get the information out. I know that in terms of addressing the kids with the lead poisoning, I know over 25% of the kids tested had elevated levels of lead. A number of them were above 10, some of them over 15. By the time people started responding, like every employee's cars had to be cleaned multiple times. Lead was in the homes that was tracked in, and this was only from people that were able to connect with. There are many employees that were not able to be connected, and there were, I'm sure, lead entered up in their homes. And the problem is we were dealing with an immigrant community that had poor language skills. What are the lessons that you've learned from there that can help address this problem in the future so that we get a more timely response, particularly when we were working with a community that was in fear of if they said anything that they're going to lose their jobs from their employers? You can see the things that were involved. We were dealing with a very bad corporate actor, but I feel there's some things that statewide could be done. So what are the lessons that you've learned from that that can help address these kind of conditions in a speedier way, and what is the things of communication that have been improved between the departments so that people can respond much more quickly than they did in this instance?
And so before he answers, thank you, Representative Fisher. That's a huge issue, and it, of course, it's related, but I think that could be the subject of a whole other hearing. So, Mr. Huff, if you have any really brief answer, that would be fine. Otherwise, I think we might want to hold that for another day so we can deal with the bills.
But I did want to park that out there because there is a larger problem. I do understand that we won't get to the
Thank you, Representative
today.
Fisher. Mr. Huff, anything you want to add to what Representative Fisher laid out?
Madam Chair and Representative Fisher. And Representative Fisher, I'll just say we very much appreciate your support during that time. We look to engage with all of Minnesotans, regardless of their ethnicity, regardless of their language. And so in that instance, we partnered with some community-based organizations that were based in the community to help us do outreach. With your assistance, we did update some of our authorities in last session to help to respond to situations like that. So hopefully that provides a brief overview.
Madam Chair and Representative. Thank you. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Huff, and thank you to all the folks at MDH for the presentation and for the work that you do. So let's move now to House File 92. So we have Representative Jordan here, and since she's not on the committee, I will move that House File 92 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And welcome to the committee, Representative Jordan. And let's see, there's no author's amendment on this, I don't think. We don't have one. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. So Representative Jordan, go ahead and present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. I'll be quick with this bill because we just did a pretty large lead overview, and I have some great testifiers. So House File 92 modifies the definition of an elevated blood level to 3.5 micrograms of lead per deciliter of whole blood. And current statute sets it at 10 micrograms per deciliter, and then in 2014, our health commissioner determined 5 micrograms per deciliter was the appropriate measure. Since then, the CDC has set 3.5 micrograms per deciliter as an elevated blood level of lead for children who, as you just heard, are the most vulnerable to lead poisoning. They are also the folks that we capture children a lot more in this blood level because we're testing them with their well-child checkups. And so by adjusting the definition of an elevated blood level, the state and our local health departments will be able to provide those remediation services to more children and families who are experiencing the adverse effects of lead exposure. Remember, members, no amount of exposure to lead is safe. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn over the presentation to Dr. Dominic Dabrowski.
Welcome to the committee. If you just state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Certainly, Madam Secretary. My name is Dr. Dominic Dabrowski. I work over at Health Partners in Minneapolis and St. Paul in the Occupational and Environmental Medicine Department. And so I believe that this bill is an important bill since national trends seem to be trending downward, ever downward with lead, and that is absolutely 100% necessary. As we've heard earlier today, there's no amount of safe lead level. The focus has been on children, and certainly children are more vulnerable and should be considered, but I want to be careful in how I say this. There is more to the story than that. It is not simply neurodevelopmental disorders in children, lowering IQ. There is more that lead can do that can be almost taken for granted, just because they may not be seen as serious. For example, lead has been linked to hypertension. Lead has been linked to decreased libido, fatigue, decreased concentration. These are things that would not necessarily get a diagnosis and get you put in a hospital. However, these are things that would contribute to, as a social determinant of health, bring down people's wellness overall. And it doesn't need to be a very high lead level. It gets unclear at low lead levels how much these contribute to, let's say, hypertension, and how much it is your salty diet or how much you exercise or how much you sleep. However, what is clear is that it does not help. Any amount of lead will contribute towards those things and should be considered as well. Another thing that hasn't been touched on that is a little more serious is cancer. According to the International Agency of Research for Cancer, lead is a carcinogen in human and animal models, as it has been linked to bladder cancer, stomach cancer, liver cancer, other GI cancers, etc. It has been linked to nephrosclerosis, which is the hardening of your kidneys, which is probably how the hypertension is somewhat contributed. It diminishes immunity by attacking your lymphocytes, and it can even lead to abnormalities in sperm content, in sperm quality. So there's really no system that isn't in some way poisoned by lead. It is toxic. It is bad at the smallest amounts. Absolute zero is the only safe value.
Great. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? All right, not seeing anyone, so thank you. I think we can close testimony and see if there are any member questions. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, Representative Jordan, thank you for bringing this, is it appears as though the Department of Health has the ability to change, lower or raise the rate through its rulemaking process. I'm not very smart when it comes to elevated blood levels. I'm wondering why you think the legislature should usurp that position and kind of take that over rather than leaving the Department of Health commissioner to make that determination on their own, especially since we may be investing a bunch of resources and maybe that could be lifted at some point. I'm just curious.
Representative Jordan.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, the 3.5 would bring Minnesota into compliance with the CDC guidelines of 3.5 and make more children eligible for these services. I think that's important, and I think it's the role of the legislature to determine things like this.
Representative Nadeau, follow up? Okay. All right. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the author's indicating that our the bureaucracy that's supposed to be overseeing and protecting isn't accepting the CDC level. I mean, you seem to indicate that we have to change it because they're not changing it, and the justification is that's the CDC level. So that seems as if maybe we have a problem with the bureaucracy that's overseeing this.
Representative Jordan.
Madam Chair, it might be better for MDH to address that, but I think it's the role of the legislature to identify problems within statute and then make those changes, which is what this bill is an attempt to do. This is a bill that I have, this isn't a bill that a lobbyist brought me. This isn't a bill that someone, this is a bill that a constituent brought me and said, hey, did you know that the blood lead level limit in Minnesota statute is different from the one that is recommended and different from the one that would indicate a blood lead level limit, an elevated blood lead level limit. And so I thought that was a problem, so I wrote a bill, and that's why we're here.
So Representative,
go ahead, Chair.
Okay, so Representative Jordan, I think it does bear a little bit more explaining. So first of all, if members look at the bill, right now we have 10 micrograms in statute. So this is statutory. But to Representative Nadeau's point, the department, we heard testimony, the department was de facto using a 5 level instead of the one that's in statute. But My understanding, maybe I misheard this, that was only in certain counties that that was being used as a, as the level. So it was, so just to be clear, what this does is it sets a level that triggers the provision of services. And so that is for the entire state. Am I correct? So if the, you know, certain counties could, of course, say, well, we're going to start giving services at 5. But this sets it across the state, and explain, if you would, exactly, you know, what happens now with this change.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so the way it is addressed is that MDH certainly works with local health departments to do these lead to provide these lead remediation services that I believe Dr. Yendel talked about, where you know, as someone from the health department goes in, a lot of times it's a local health department contracting out for the state. In Minneapolis, the city of Minneapolis Health Department takes care of that, and then in Ramsey County is the entity that takes that into consideration. And so MDH is setting it for the state as a whole, and then in Hennepin County, in Minneapolis, the Minneapolis Health Department does it, and in Ramsey County sets that. And so what happens is you bring your child in for their well check at around 2 years of age, and they do a blood test, and they might find an elevated blood level. That would mean that then the health department could come to your home, do some lead surveillance, identify, oh, it's a service line issue, or, oh, there's actually some lead in your backyard, and your child is a two-year-old and playing in the dirt, which is what all two-year-olds do. It's fun. And so they identify those potential exposures to lead and then help the family say, oh, you need to get rid of this paint because your two-year-old is putting it in their mouth, because that's what two-year-olds do. And so this is to extend these services to these families to do the lead remediation, if that makes more sense, Madam Chair.
Okay, I'm going to go to Representative, we have Quam, Murphy, and then Keel. So Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And clarifying, you know, we're hearing testimony that no level is safe, and we're hearing that, well, here the level is there. It bothers me that where you live apparently determines the level, and that our, you know, department's supposed to be covering health has a higher level than what the CDC is, because, you know, my assumption is at the federal level, they have a lot more data. They've got data for multiple states. And so when they set a limit, you know, that should be a bit more of a gauge. So it's not trivial to be concerned. There's variable determinations of what's okay. And to me, that's not okay. And that might require some tweaking to this bill or another bill. But if it's serious, it's serious, whether you live in this county or that county. And I hope we do take this seriously as this bill moves and other bills move forward.
Thank you. Representative Jordan.
Madam Chair, this is a serious bill. And that it is true that there is no amount of exposure to lead that is safe. The 3.5 micrograms of lead per deciliter would be considered an elevated level of blood. And lead would be I get very tripped up with all the L sounds in blood lead level pills. But this is a trigger. So once your blood is elevated enough to be 3.5 deciliters, that is what triggers all of it into place. Right now, that trigger happens at 5. And that is what I know the health department is enforcing. I don't think it is 10 anywhere in state that I know of. I can be corrected if that is the case. But this is a serious issue, and I want to make sure that we're taking it seriously and connecting people with the services they need when they have that elevated and very dangerous level of contamination in their blood.
Right, and the point about it being uniform is a very good point that Representative Quam is making. Representative Murphy, and then Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Secretary, if I could contribute just one quick point to that.
Dr. Dabrowski,
I don't know the protocol, so I apologize if I overstepped. So the problem, especially with children, is that as we spoke earlier about chelation therapy, that isn't done until you're well into the 40s, 50s, or 60s, the level of lead. So that's far higher than the level that even the most liberal approach would take at 10. So especially with children, lead will accumulate in the body, and it takes a long time to clear. Just to take an example from a clinical case that I saw recently, from a lead level of approximately 20 to 10, it took about 15, 16 months to drop off that much for the body to clear naturally. And that's bad enough for an adult, but with a child, that is where those neurodevelopmental concerns come into play. You've got a year and a half to 2 years of elevated lead that's simply poisoning you before your body can naturally clear it, and therapy's not even available. So that is one of the other reasons why there's a particular concern for children as well. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Sorry, Representative Murphy.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jordan, my question is why do we take the CDC's advisory over the Minnesota Department of Health recommendation? I thought that was our kind of controlling, you know, entity here, not the CDC.
Representative Jordan.
Madam Chair, the CDC is a national organization that provides health guidelines and advice for everyone in the country. And so we took the CDC guidelines. I took the CDC guidelines of this that would be more protective of Minnesotans and then wrote a bill. So that's where that number came from is, yes, I think it's a good thing that the health department is enforcing 5 microliters, but we can do better. There is guidance out there from a well-respected source that says we can do better, and that's how the statute came to be. Proposal.
Right. Representative,
yeah, I'm just going to go back to the, you know, their advisory. So we have to do a lot of our own due diligence to know if it's moving down, if the half-life is different from 5 to 3.5. We heard a little bit about that from Dr. Chu. We need to know a lot of that stuff. So from us to just say, well, the CDC picked it, so that's our new number. That's the only concern I have. I have no concern about getting rid of the lead. We need to. But this is going to be based on how much we spend, where we spend it, how many feet. All that stuff. So I just think that the advisory from the CDC is concerning to me.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand this is serious. And just thinking about, while it's really important that we make sure that we're protecting our children, I think this might be putting our communities in a real pickle. Or our counties, or our public health, because unless we've got something else that we're going to talk about, that's kind of what I thought. Joe tells me that, excuse me, Representative Schumacher tells me that we'll be talking about it. But the concern is that we are putting a predicament into our small communities that more than likely need to replace pipelines. And that becomes a bigger problem to be able to do that in that time frame. So my concern would be is that we make sure that our communities can handle the changes.
Well, Representative Keel, I think you're teeing up the rest of our discussion here. Representative Jordan.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Keel, if you want to get rid of lead service lines, have I got the bill for you. And I think that is, you will hear from a lot of our communities across the state about the need for that. So I don't disagree. And in fact, can't wait to talk to you about it, which I think is next.
All right.
Sounds good.
So we have Fisher and then New Brindley, and then let's move on because we do have other bills, and they're all related. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to thank Senator Representative Jordan for bringing this forward. I know. I didn't mean to insult you there. I will say that it would have been great if this would have been done much earlier, and I'm thinking back to the Water Gremlin example as a perfect example. They could have gotten on that problem a lot earlier than they did, I think, if we had this lower level. So it's something that when the federals are saying, hey, we should be looking at it, this is earlier detection so that we can get at the problems quicker so that we don't get the higher elevated levels happening to our children. I think it's for our safety of our not only our kids, but also our local community, when it's a broader concern than just something that's confined to the home. When it starts going to the workplace, this gets us the opportunity to start addressing those issues earlier. And in terms of other issues, I do have a bill coming out that's going to housing to address the paint in housing. So we are addressing this for many issues. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Fisher. Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. And Representative Keel brings up a good point. And, you know, it's my understanding that these bills are all being laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative New Brindley, this one is, but they're not all being laid over. Some of them have other stops to make.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So this one is being laid over. And so I hope that, you know, when the rubber hits the road and we actually have to do math at the end of the session, I hope we'll consider that, because that is concerning to move this bill without funding for those local municipalities who would really struggle to meet those mandates and requirements without funding to do so. So I hope that, you know, I mean, these are coming forward in different bills, but I hope that as we move forward this session, they're considered together, because that certainly would be a concerning mandate for local municipalities.
Right, and I'll let Representative Jordan have the final word on the bill, but I just would say that the math is going to be done before the end of session on this. I would guess. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yep, we'll talk about some math with the next bill. This bill really is, because we know that this isn't to say that we're moving from what was a 3.5 is an elevated and highly dangerous level of blood concentration to have. Your level of lead concentration in your blood to have. This is an extremely concerning thing. If my child had a elevated blood lead level of 3.5, I would want them to have services, and I would want to be able to have the assistance and know about how to protect my child from that exposure. So I hope members can keep this in mind. This is one of those bills that really shows about what the level is, and then I do have a number of other proposals on how to actually bring that down. So we will be needing to provide services to fewer people.
All right. Thank you, Representative Jordan. So House File 92 is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And now we'll move to House File 24, which is also Representative Jordan. So the chair moves that House File 24 be re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. And this one, there's no author's amendment on this. Is there either, Representative Jordan?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, so go ahead and present the bill, Representative Jordan.
Well, thank you, Chair Liebling, and good morning again, members of the committee. It is an honor to be part of Lead Day again, and I'm excited to present House File 24 now, which is a bill to protect Minnesotans from exposure to lead in their drinking water through those lead service lines. This is fundamentally a bill to protect Minnesotans from exposure to lead, and remember that no amount of exposure to lead is safe. Lead service lines are one of the largest sources of lead in Minnesota's drinking water, and as we've heard, these service lines are often both publicly and privately owned, and you can't replace half of a service line. You have to replace the entire lead service line, so the public and private part, simultaneously to avoid increasing concentration of lead in the drinking water. This is a statewide issue. Lead lines are present across Minnesota in all communities, urban, suburban, and rural. You saw that map where there was lots of concentrations across the state of lead as a huge problem. But lead exposure through service lines is most common in low-income communities. And as we've also heard, there isn't a comprehensive map of these lead lines. And so this bill is critical not only for the health and safety of our constituents and their drinking water, but it's also critical that we pass this bill now to maximize federal funding provided by the bipartisan infrastructure law Congress passed in 2021, and to provide the assistance that Minnesota communities need to be in compliance with the federal law that Mr. Polstead was discussing. So here's what House File 24 does. It establishes eligible recipients and uses of the grants to replace lead service lines. Recipients include community public water suppliers, municipalities, or other suppliers of residential drinking water systems, and any applicant eligible for loans and grants under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. Uses include removing and replacing the lines, construction related to that, providing information, so, you know, the people who are going to send out a postcard saying, hey, we're replacing lead service lines in your community on this date. And then also repaying debt that has been incurred from actually replacing these lead lines. Grant money can be used to pay for 100% of the cost of replacing privately owned lead lines and only 50% of those lines that are publicly owned. It also promotes planning and says this bill says that the PFA must give priorities to cities, local water systems, and other applicants that use grant money to maximize the removal of lead lines. It also says that these plans need to include the following, how to participate, how to maximize property owners, how to maximize the most efficient use of funds, how to minimize or avoid the partial replacement of lead lines, which remember, you can't partially replace them without actually increasing the concentration of lead, and how equity for disadvantaged groups is prioritized in the plan. This bill also requires that grant applicants that have at least 50,000 water connections must submit a workforce plan as part of their application that describes how the applicant will maximize the use of registered apprentices and workers from communities that are underrepresented in Minnesota's construction industry. There's a prevailing wage provision and would require a report every year from PFA or the Public Facilities Authority to us, the legislature, on the operation of the grant program. There is also grants in there for mapping. We know that many of our communities, especially the smallest communities in Minnesota, will have to comply with the federal rule to have a map, and they're going to need our help to do so. So this is a bill that both gets rid of the lead lines, make sure that we're addressing the problem, and also maximizes federal funding match from the IIJA. And with that, Madam Chair, I would like to proceed to testimony and discussion.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Jordan. So we have on the list Patrick Shea from St. Paul Regional Water Services. Welcome to the committee. If you would just introduce yourself to the committee and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Shea. I'm the general manager of St. Paul Regional Water Services. So thank you very much for providing me the opportunity to testify today in favor of House File 24. So St. Paul Regional Water Services is a regional utility providing drinking water to over 450,000 residents in the St. Paul and surrounding communities. We are governed by the Board of Water Commissioners. So we're a component unit of the City of St. Paul, but we're actually a separate governmental unit. Our water system consists of nearly 100,000 services. Not to confuse the 100,000 lead services, 26,000 of our service lines are either completely or partially composed of lead. So we could be up to one quarter of the issue we're talking about today. These assets, as Representative Jordan mentioned, are not completely owned by the public or by the utility. There's a dual ownership. So about 70% of our need is on the private side, 30% is on the public side. So if we were to use user rates to try to get the lead out, we could get rid of 30% of the issue. As a provider of drinking water, providing safe, reliable drinking water is not just the goal of our utility and our staff members and the board, but it's also the passion of what we do. So we take lead in drinking water to be a very serious health concern. In March of 2022, the Board of Water Commissioners directed staff at St. Paul Regional Water Services to develop and begin implementation of a 10-year lead service line replacement program. We've had some pretty good luck and some pretty good fortune in 2022 and have learned a lot, including some of the bureaucracies that you have to overcome as far as federal procurement, some of the policies and procedures, record keeping and such. So along with help from the Minnesota Department of Health and some grant funding, we also were able to at the generosity of the City of St. Paul to use American Rescue Plan dollars to implement some of the measures that we're talking about as far that are related to lead-free SPRWS. What we are currently lacking again is that 70% funding. There's some restrictions on what we can do with the public dollars we'll receive from user rates. We can't pass those dollars along to a private initiative such as lead service line replacements. So without additional federal and state dollars, we will fall well short of the goal of this 10-year program. For this reason, we strongly support House File 24 and the initiatives that both the Public Facilities Authority and the Health Department are putting into this effort to be able to rid not only St. Paul Regional Water Services customers of lead service lines, but also the state of Minnesota. So as the provider of water in this building, me and my staff are always available for questions and to provide any information that you would have related to lead or the drinking water that you get to enjoy every day as part of your work. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is John Thorson.
Good
Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is John Thorson. I'm Legislative Director for LIUNA Minnesota, North Dakota. We're Minnesota's infrastructure union representing 13,000 skilled construction laborers who build and maintain our roads, highways, bridges, and the basic utilities that allow our communities to thrive. We're proud to stand with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, Conservation Minnesota, the Operating Engineers Local 49, and the St. Paul Regional Water Services in seeking a transformational investment in our state's future that puts us on a path to remove what the Minnesota Department of Health estimates to be over 100,000 lead service lines in communities throughout our entire state. We strongly support the provisions of House File 24 that call for eliminating all lead service lines by 2033 and provide the funding necessary to ensure cities can map, identify, and replace lead pipes both in the public right-of-way and the 70% of service lines on private property. This is an issue throughout the entire state. This is not a metro or greater Minnesota issue. And who's at risk of having water through lead service lines is Minnesotans living in older homes, especially those that were constructed before 1945. Historically, lead was used because it was less expensive than iron, could more easily be bent around existing structures without leaking, and allowed more durable connections to stiffer pipes that expand and contract during the winter. With temperature changes. LIUNA members are skilled in lead service line replacement and have worked with cities throughout the nation to accelerate the identification and removal of lead pipes in our communities. Here in Minnesota, it's estimated that removal and replacement of lead service pipes will create and maintain around 2,400 jobs annually over the next 10 years. We're very excited about the career and economic inclusion opportunities this brings to Minnesota's construction industry through union registered apprenticeship programs that increase participation of women, people of color, veterans, and others not yet fully participating in our economy. The socioeconomic impacts of a job that pays middle class wages, provides comprehensive family health care and retirement benefits, and offers training and career advancement can exceed those created by a lower wage, low benefit job by a factor of five or more. So Madam Chair, I want to thank Representative Jordan for bringing this proposal forward and encourage members of the committee to support House File 24 and these critical state investments to ensure that lead pipes are replaced and clean drinking water is delivered to families and children across Minnesota. This investment will increase the health, social, and economic vitality of our entire state. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Thorson. And lastly, on the list here, we have Marty Seifert. Former Representative Marty Seifert.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Good to see you.
Madam Chair, what a pleasure it is to be with you today. My first time in this committee ever. And
what took you so long?
I avoided it, not because of you, Madam Chair, but it's a complicated subject,
say.
Health and Human Services. So, Madam Chair, thank you so much. It's so good to serve with you and to see you again. And for Representative Jordan for bringing this bill forward, I sat in your chairs for 14 years and trying to do the Lord's work and the devil's workshop here is tough at the Capitol. But what I can tell you, Madam Chair, members, is that, first of all, my name is Marty Seifert. I represent 110 rural cities through the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. And what Representative Jordan is trying to do is, particularly for our communities, for those of you who have rural cities in your districts, is solve a problem that I think is a basic need. Basic clean water is a role of government. For those of us who debate on the House floor about the role of government, I think you'd have a hard time finding anyone saying that we shouldn't have clean drinking water for our citizens. And so what Representative Jordan is trying to do here is find an affordable way, and I know this is an expensive bill if you look at the overall cost of it, but What the question is if you don't pass this bill, then what is the result going to be? And for not passing this bill, by October 24th of 2024, we have to have a plan put in place to deal with this. And I think a lot of you are smart enough to know that in places like Mississippi and Michigan, they literally are poisoning their citizens. And in Minnesota, we're smarter than that. We're going to get ahead of this. We're going to identify these lead pipes. Homes built before 1940 tend to have had lead service lines. Houses built before 1986 tend to have lead-based components in them many times, lead parts. And in greater Minnesota, our incomes are $53,000 a year on average. In the metro, it's $93,000. So for the folks of you who have rural districts, she's taking care of your districts to make sure that your water fees are not doubled, tripled, and quadrupled. The little old ladies in your district aren't literally taxed out of their homes to try to be able to afford clean drinking water that we're all entitled to. And so from my perspective, members, you're going to do several things. A, you're going to solve the problem. You're going to get ahead of it. B, you're going to utilize every dollar that the federal government has, and Representative Jordan has devised a plan to be able to utilize all of the dollars the federal government is going to come forward with. And lastly, be able to try to get this done over a time frame. Not that it's a permanent program that goes on forever, but we're going to solve the problem and be done with it. And I think Minnesota does that very often and does it well. So, Madam Chair, members, we advocate for this bill. We realize it is a hefty price tag, but what is the price, members, if we don't do this? And I want you to ask that question to yourself. Yes, it's expensive. Yes, it's a large task. But the question is, if you don't pass this bill, what is the price to pay? No one wants to have our families drinking lead-seeped water. And so with that, Madam Chair, thank you. It's such a pleasure to see you again. I don't get before Human Services ever.
And this isn't Human Services.
I could stand for any question that you might have.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Seifert. Really appreciate your testimony. So we can take a few questions. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and former Representative Seifert. Because you have people in the group that you're representing across the entire state, my concerns are the norm for today is shortage of workforce and scarcity of materials. This problem is the entire state. Has there been any discussion amongst your group and the other entities about setting up maybe regional areas so that we can have activity going on across the state and address the higher levels first, sort of coordinating so that we don't have to wait 10 years to have the worst cases in different parts of the state addressed?
Mr. Seifert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Quam. We're just getting on the front end of this, Representative Quam. We have to have our plans developed by October 24th to 24, trying to get the problem solved, I think, within 7 years after that. So our cities will be quantifying the problems. I could phone a friend, Madam Chair. I think Mr. Freeman is in the audience from the PFA. To talk about how they're looking at implementing this on a large scale. They do have, obviously, the PFA, Representative Quam, has a process in place of how they pick need over want, how they pick the most critical areas first, and then they go from there. So if you want, Madam Chair, I think you could give a couple minutes of help on that question, or just for the members to know what's going to happen once this bill passes.
Okay, well, this bill does have some other stops, and I think this might, I don't know. I mean, we could maybe do a 1 or 2 minutes on that. Okay, come on down. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. We are the financing agency for the state that works with cities across the state to finance water infrastructure projects. A significant part of the new federal infrastructure bill funding is specifically dedicated to removal of lead service lines comes through the PFA's drinking water state revolving fund program. So the process of cities applying to get on the health department's project priority list And then our intended use plan and moving through that funding process will be very similar for these projects. However, some of the similarity stops there because these are very different types of projects. So we will be working with cities. We actually have, I think, about a dozen cities on our current 2023 project list that have submitted initial proposals for doing this work with the first year of the federal funds. Those include big cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, St. Cloud, also a number of smaller communities. And I think the issue of the question raised by Representative Quam, how the contracting will work, I think that will need to be worked out, but it will be different, probably, I'm thinking, between different cities, bigger cities, smaller cities. It'll also depend somewhat on the nature of the project area that the city is trying to address, whether there's one general contractor working in the whole area, perhaps in coordination with the city replacing its own city water main as part of the project, or if it's more individual households, probably smaller plumbing contractors coordinating work on individual households. I think a lot of that still needs to be worked out, and it will be kind of each city sort of deciding what makes the most sense for them. The idea of some sort of coordination regionally, I think, is an interesting one and something we can look at.
All right. Thank you very much. We have a couple more members on the list. Hopefully we can do these quickly and get to the next bill. So Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Rasmussen. I like this idea so much. I'm gonna name this.
George,
I'm sorry.
Now I'm being called the senator for the second time today.
I'm sorry. it's Representative Fisher's fault. I like it so much that I'm gonna give you the. This is okay. Get the lead out, Bill. This is. I like this. I do have a couple of challenges that I'd like you to think about. I worry that because of the density and the age of the infrastructure, that a vast majority of these resources are going to be consumed in the metro. I think it's going to harm rural Minnesota. They don't have the infrastructure out there, both physical and human, to actually tap into these resources as readily as the metro area. And I think that should be a concern. And maybe you put some formulary together that ensures that money does go out into the rural area if this bill continues. The second thing that I bring up is that maybe we think about this, and it goes towards Representative Quam's point, is counties have the resources to be able to administer grants in a very effective, very efficient way. Is there a way that we can utilize these resources more effectively by having counties be the recipients of these grants, put a program together, so it's direct, so that people have the ability to tap into the resources, hire a contractor of their choice, utilize the resources quicker, more efficiently. And if the county wants to create, theoretically, a grant program for low-income individuals and a revolving loan fund for those creditworthy, wealthy individuals that could be interest-free, I just think there's an opportunity to do more, a lot more, if we think about those things moving forward.
Representative Jordan?
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau. So the eligible recipients are defined in this bill as community public water suppliers of a community water system, municipalities, suppliers of other residential drinking water systems, and anyone eligible for grants or loans under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. So those are the recipients. It's not just a city or a township. And a lot of this also aligns with the IIJA. And I think if you have a question about whether our smaller and rural cities are up to the task and want it, I would defer to Mr. Seifert.
Mr. Seifert, briefly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jordan was right. Representative Nadeau, mainly cities, municipalities are responsible for drinking water, and the counties do county roads and their types of things. But for the most part, or all parts, our cities stand ready to do this. For the smaller cities who don't have in-house staff, We utilize consultants for developing this, and we will try to do as much economy of scale as we can to work together as multiple communities. Representative Quam, I think, alluded to that a little bit, because you have a limited number of people, engineers, contractors, and people able to actually do this work. And so we will work together to get another entity of government involved in it. We're probably a little bit hesitant about that because we're trying to stay in our lane on the municipal side of providing the water. And we think we have the capabilities of doing that. I appreciate the question because I think it's very valid.
Okay. And I'm going to go on to Representative Keel. And I, just members, I know there's a ton of interest in this. It's a very important issue. We're kind of way off of the health piece of it, though, so we do need to move on because we have other bills. So Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to point out the time frame, I understand you are trying to manage a lot of conversation or a lot of bills, but I think it is really important for us in the Health Committee to understand the particulars of these bills because we're going to the floor and having a conversation again. And the more educated we are in the Health Committee, I don't serve on some of the other committees that are going to be heard. This bill is going to be heard, so I think that's important. I just wanted to point that out. My other concern is, and maybe this, Representative Jordan, you certainly can respond to this, Marty Seifert, but I'm concerned about prevailing wage. I know everybody tells me, oh, it doesn't affect us in rural Minnesota, but I think that it can be a considerable problem in getting more than one community fixed in my small communities because we don't have the ability to get the workforce. I had a school district call me today, and they have got a plan that now is falling apart. The board of, it's another subject, but they're really stressed on trying to get any work done in rural Minnesota. And I live in a very rural area. So just coming and working distance-wise doesn't even mean there might be a hotel for them to work at a time frame. But I want us to really consider, I understand prevailing wages to protect workers. On the other hand, I think it is really detrimental to our small communities and how we employ. And I believe that we don't have to worry about employing anybody. We just need bodies to get this work done. And my communities, Mr. Freeman, we can talk offline, but I have one community that can't seem to get a grant to replace water lines, and other things have been afforded them, but they can't dig the roads because they need the money to do the lines. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, Representative Kill, we're not going to discuss prevailing wage here in the Health Committee, so I think we're going to move on here and take a vote on the bill. So Representative Bonner, did you want to speak? No. Okay. All right. So so I'm going to renew my motion that House File 24 be recommended to be re-referred to the Environment, Natural Resources, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to its next stop. Thank you very much. And now we're going to call up Representative Howard. And Representative Jordan, you're going to stick around and see if we can get to any of the other bills that we're going to talk about but not move today. So Representative Howard, welcome to the committee. The chair will move that House File 347 be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. And there is an author's amendment, so the chair will move the A3 to put the bill in its intended form for discussion. Is that correct, Representative Howard?
Yes, Chair Liebling.
All right, so let's adopt the amendment. It's a technical amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. So all those in favor of adoption of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. So Representative Howard, please present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and committee. Members, you've already heard a lot today about the dangerous impact of lead, and this bill deals with the impact of lead in school drinking water. Members, by the time most of our kids graduate from high school, they will have spent more than 15,000 hours at school. It's vital that we ensure that the water that they are drinking is safe from lead. Minnesota, on a bipartisan basis, established some best practices to test and remediate for lead about 5 years ago. But since, the availability of better health and scientific data shows that we can and should do better. So what this bill does is take steps to make sure that the water in our schools that our students are drinking is safe. And again, I won't go into some of the details about the dangerous impacts because we've already heard about them, and would remind folks that there is no safe for lead, level for lead. And so this bill does a few things. First, it sets out for to strengthen our knowledge and scope of what's going on with this issue across the state. Some national surveys data shows that 30-40% of schools are dealing with the impacts of elevated lead levels. This would create some centralized reporting so we as policymakers in the state and the public can have greater transparency and greater awareness about the challenges that our schools are facing in terms of lead in drinking water. Second, we strengthen the standard of acceptable levels of lead from 15 parts per billion to 5 parts per billion. And as other bills have discussed, again, there's no safe levels of lead, but there is strong research that at levels above 5, we start to see those negative health impacts that we've heard about. And of note, 5 parts per billion, that's the standard that the USDA says is safe for bottled water. And so that's in part where this 5 parts per billion standard comes from. Third, if we're going to be asking our districts to mitigate for lead levels at this lower level, that's going to be a cost. And so this bill provides a funding source for our school districts to complete that remediation. I think if we're going to ask our districts to do this work, that we should provide that funding to make sure that it moves forward. Lastly, I just want to thank the department's MDH, MDA, and representatives from school districts who have continued to collaborate and work on this bill for more than a year. Their contributions has built a stronger bill and a stronger product. Members, this has been a bipartisan bill as it's moved through last year and hopeful this year as well. It seems like an issue that we can work together on and move forward. It's vitally important.
All right. Thank you, Representative Howard. So on the list to testify, I have Stephen Ring. Stephen Ring present? Good. Welcome to the committee. And if you would just introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee. My name is Steve Ring, and I'm here as a volunteer on behalf of the Sierra Club North Star chapter. I chair their Waters and Wetlands Stewards Committee. I also worked for more than 30 years at the Minnesota Department of Health, much of that time in the public health laboratory, doing lab analysis of probable toxins and pollutants. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of House File 347. First, I want to thank the legislature for passing the school lead protection bill in 2018. That was a big step forward, and it is the foundation for HF 347. Assistant Commissioner Huff explained the toxicity of lead to children. I'd just like to really reiterate, lead exposure is cumulative. Lead that is brought into the body from one source is added to the burden from previous exposures. There's no known therapy for lead in low concentrations in the blood. High concentrations, yes. Low concentrations, no. And finally, lead damage is permanent, so preventing exposure in the first place is critical. Virtually every agency, academy, and nation that regulates lead concentrations in drinking water has tightened their earlier recommended levels. Many now advocate for the 5 parts per billion standard that this bill requires. The FDA requires bottled water to meet the 5 parts per billion standard. More strongly, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that water fountains in schools do not exceed water lead concentrations of 1 part per billion. The standard included in this bill presents a major step toward reducing children's exposure to lead. The 2018 bill realized that lead in drinking water can come from faucets, valves, taps, internal plumbing lines, and lead in solder. Schools are places where lead concentrations can build up in water during sitting dormant in pipes for extended durations during weekends, vacations, and summer breaks. It is also not surprising that elevated lead concentrations have been associated with low-income communities, both urban and rural, with older plumbing systems. The 2018 Minnesota law required public reporting of lead testing results, but there was no standard format and no central repository for that information. Those provisions in this bill will have a huge benefit for protecting Minnesota kids. Reliable data will allow us to track trends and identify problems that might otherwise be missed. It will be easier to establish patterns, to learn from common problems in different school districts, and to create a picture of how well Minnesota is addressing the school lead problem. We understand that we must support schools to move down to the lowest possible lead levels. That's why it's so important that funding be attached to this bill for grants to replace fixtures and add filters to fountains and faucets. We want schools to recognize that they will have support for addressing this issue. I urge you to support House File 347. And again, I thank you for the opportunity to speak to this issue.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room here who would like to testify on the bill? Not seeing anyone. And are there any questions from members? Any discussion? No discussion. Okay, Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Sorry about that. I was just wondering, you're talking about the 5 parts per billion, and earlier we talked about 3.5. you know, just the whole issue about half-life, the science behind why we go from 5 to 3.5. I haven't heard anything about why we're doing it other than lower is better. But when it comes to allocating money and prioritizing projects, it matters where we're at. So can you tell me how we got from 3 to 5 to 3.5? And I know yours is at 5, but we're talking about both. These are all on the table. I want some information back from you as far as the whole part per billion.
So. Representative Howard.
Chair Liebling, Representative Murphy. So in this bill, and I can only, I'm speaking to this bill, the drop from 15 to 5 is based on a couple things. More available data about the dangerous levels when you get above that 5 level. And again, there is no safe level. But at that, going from 15 to the 5 threshold represents what some other states have done in terms of showing some leadership to go down to a lower level. And as I mentioned, at that 5 parts per billion, that's a number that has been used for the bottled water that we drink. I was surprised that that number is a, when I learned about that, that there's any number that's acceptable. As I understand, with some testing, it's hard to get a reading that's literally 0.000. And so that's just to give you a little background, but the 5 parts per billion comes to get to a better, more standardized number.
All right. Representative Murphy, any follow-up quickly? And we've got a number of members on the list now.
Yeah, so. Just, you know, it's possible to find anything in anything if you go far enough down. And so that's the only part. I mean, it is relative. Half-life is relative, how fast we can get rid of it. You know, those are all relative points. So the parts per million or parts per billion to try to identify the level of risk, it's important. So that's, it's nice to have the risk that goes along with the what's the relative risk? So that was my reason for asking. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Every member on the list is telling me it's just short. It's just short. Okay. We'll see. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think one of the confusion things is when we were hearing on the numbers, the numbers we were hearing earlier were having to do with numbers when measured in blood. And so that uses a different measurement versus these numbers here, which is what's happening in the environment that then adds up in the blood. So that's why, and it gets a little confusing because I had to read it a couple of times myself. So just trying to clarify.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think as we go through these, the point is I would prefer the lower levels be targeted at child care, elementary schools, and that would be the bias if we're going to have lower and not uniform. Thank you.
Representative Howard, did you want to speak to that at all?
Chair Liebling and Representative Quam, I would say that I see the point of that when we're talking about development, it's really important that we target our youngest learners. I would just say that I think any elevated levels, if we have elevated levels of in our high schools or what have you, I think that's a problem too. And so I guess that would be my response.
Okay. And And I guess, too, one bill can't do everything, too, right? So Representative Hemmingson-Yeager?
Thanks. Representative Fisher got it, so we're good. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Very good. All right. Any final words, Representative Howard?
Just Chair Liebling and members, I appreciate the conversation and partnership on this bill and would urge a yes vote.
All right. Thank you very much. So the chair will renew the motion that House Bill 347, as amended, be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you very much, Representative Howard.
Thank you.
And your testifier. So we do have 5 more minutes. We have a couple of bills that we were going to hear informationally. I think we can. Come on down, Representative Jordan. These, we don't have these actually introduced, but my understanding is these are part of the, there are the jackets, but we just, because we're talking about lead today, we wanted to see if we could include these. I believe these come from the Department of Health, right? This is part of their budget proposal for the year. So, Representative Jordan, if you want to just go ahead and talk about these bills.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So there are 2 provisions that are in front of you. They are both agency bills that I've been working on with MDH. One of them would enable MDH to develop rules consistent with the federal Renovate, Repair, and Paint, or RRP rule. Those jackets have not been received yet. And this proposal makes a number of policy changes that were discovered in the course of developing MDH's RRP rule. The first change addresses differences between the lead abatement and RRP rule de minimis thresholds. Currently, we're not in compliance with federal standards here, and this change will alleviate confusion among certified lead firms submitting lead hazard reduction notifications to the department. The second part addresses the primary intent issue with regard to lead hazard reduction and renovation work in residences and child-occupied facilities. To accomplish this, we move back to the original lead law language from pre-2009 regarding primary intent and place it under the revised definition of a lead hazard reduction. The third part revises the definition of a certified renovation firm so that it is aligned with the federal standard. The second proposal is the one I have jackets for if anyone wants to sign on to it. This proposal is nothing but definitions. So this is necessary to better facilitate replacing lead infrastructure as it relates to plumbing primarily. And I know MDH is on hand. We have a great crew from MDH here that can answer questions about these bills and their implementation specifically.
Well, great. Thank you, Representative Jordan. We do have just a few minutes here. So does anybody want to come down and add anything to those? I mean, we'll actually hear them when the jackets get introduced. But it is because we have this great context here today of great. Thank you. Come on down. And if you can, kind of put these 2 proposals in context of what we've been talking about today, that would be great just to help us. I know I have trouble just kind of hearing the description and, these are all pieces that fit together. So welcome back, and please state your name again.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chad Colsted. I'm the unit supervisor for the infrastructure unit at the Department of Health. Just to kind of coordinate with Representative Jordan's bill, House File 24, part of that bill actually looks at the inventories of the lead service lines out in the distribution system. And as I mentioned earlier, those inventories need to be completed by October 16th of 2024. Part of the language requirements from EPA have certain definitions for those material types in that inventory. As you look through the bill, you notice there's some that actually define lead service line, a galvanized service line requiring replacement. I'll maybe talk about that one just a little bit for more details. What a galvanized requiring replacement service line basically is when lead stopped being used, they started using galvanized piping. So galvanized is a very shiny threaded pipe. Most of you have seen that before. That pipe is very rigid, very solid. You cannot connect it directly to a water main. So because of that, they put in what they refer to as a lead gooseneck or lead connector, which you'll see in the definitions as well, to make it able to flex and move with the frost or whatever so that pipe doesn't break. So in turn, that lead will leach off that lead connector into the galvanized pipe and accumulate on the galvanized pipe and eventually release into the resident's home. So this is all just basically clarifying those definitions to make sure that everyone's on the same page as they start to collect the inventories across the state.
All right, thank you. And okay, so Representative Jordan, any more on those?
No amount of exposure to lead is safe, Madam Chair. Thank you for highlighting that so well today.
All right, we're going to put that in the quiz. What did you learn today? That is one thing we will not forget. So thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Holstead, and to the Department of Health again. And thank you, Representative Jordan. And so we didn't bring up a bill, so there's nothing to lay over yet on this. But thank you. And with that, we are... Next hearing is next week. We're already into next week. Okay. All right. With that, we stand adjourned.